Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with composer Andrea Clearfield about music she's created inspired by the indigenous art and music of Nepal. Susan Lewis takes us to the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, where the Chronicles of Narnia, the exhibition, uses the popular children's classics and recent film adaptations as springboards for science education. Jason Piper visits the Wilma Theatre as it produces the English translation of Scorched by Waji Muawad. The play, originally written in French, has been produced over 100 times worldwide since its 2003 premiere. And ahead of the CD release of Kyle Smith's Vespers in April, we listen back to David Patrick Stern's report on last summer's recording of the piece. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In August of last year, composer Andrea Clearfield trekked through the Himalayas on horseback to the remote region of Lomontang in Nepal. Accompanying her on a mission to explore the music and art of this secluded Himalayan kingdom was the visual artist Maureen Durdak and Sienna Craig, a cultural anthropologist from Dartmouth College. From this trip comes a new collaborative performance called Lung Ta, The Wind Horse, featuring music by Clearfield performed by the Network for New Music, dance by the group Motion Dance Company, and paintings by Maureen Durdak. The piece can be experienced in a preview performance tomorrow evening and on Friday at the University of the Arts Great Hall. I met with Andrea Clearfield earlier this week and asked her if she had in fact recorded every sound on her trip.
Well, I recorded on the horse, I recorded the monks, I recorded the royal singer to the king, recorded streams and sounds of the village. Yeah, and actually I recorded more as the trip went along.
And were these, was the music forming itself as you were going along? It strikes me a lot of the time that you'll have a travel writer going out and making notes and not really having any idea what the book is going to look like. Mm-hmm. Was that the case with you, or could you hear what the eventual music was going to sound like as you were going along?
I had some sense. I think that it was really influenced by the land being up in the Himalayas and this vastness. You know, that I think even just the silence of that and the wind and the bells of the horse, you know, just these kinds of sounds, I let sort of simmer for a while. So I knew that I wanted to create something that in some way revealed something of this expanse. And then, of course, the colorful music that I heard, the ritual music and the ceremonial music and secular music all played into it. But there was another structural element in the piece that I actually went into the trek with, and that is that Maureen Durdak, the painter, had already started working on the paintings before we left. And she used as her trajectory three structures that you see up in these Himalayan regions called the Rigsum Gompo. And they're structures that are enrobed in colors made from the clay of the region. There are three of them. And they're seen as the protectors of the villages. And so each structure has a deity that's associated with it. First one is red, and it's associated with Manjushri, or wisdom. The second one is white, Avalokiteshvara, compassion. The third one is blue or black, Vajrapani, action. And when I found out that Maureen was making three paintings, each one corresponding to the color and the deity associations and so forth, I thought, what a perfect structure for music.
Nepal itself is something of a crossroads between India and China. The area you went to has been little influenced by the outside world for hundreds of years. How was that reflected in the music? I mean, was it Eastern music to begin with?
It's Tibetan music, actually. This area is quite interesting because it was formerly a part of Tibet. This is northern Nepal, very close to the Tibetan border. And I believe it was in the 19th century that the king sided with Nepal. The people up there, even though they're Nepali, they also speak Tibetan and they wear Tibetan dress and they practice Tibetan Buddhism. And so the kind of music that I heard is the music that you would hear in Tibet or Ladakh. And so the music of the royal singer to the king, with whom I had the distinct honor of having an audience with, is music that's been passed down for generations orally, and it's very pentatonic and very melodious, and tells the stories of the land, the horses, the palace. The music of the monks, the ceremonial Tibetan ritual music, is quite different because it focuses on horns, bells, cymbals, and drums. And there's a very low resonance in the voice, and especially in these monasteries that were so spacious, you could really hear the vibrations of the voice and the drums and the cymbals and the conch shells. It's very powerful music. And I think after being in the land, I feel that the music just comes right from these mountains. You know, it has to be this kind of piercing sound that one would be able to call the deities over the peaks of the Himalayas.
Andrea Clearfield, her new work, Lung Ta, The Wind Horse, featuring music performed by the Network for New Music, with dance by Group Motion Dance Company and paintings by Maureen Durdak, can be heard on Friday at 8 p.m. at the University of the Arts Great Hall. There's a pre-concert conversation on the collaborative creation of the work at 5 p.m. You can also find details of a special preview performance to benefit the Lo Kun Fen School in Nepal by following the link at our website, wrti.org. C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia have become classics in children's literature. The first story, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, was published in 1950. It and others from the 7-book series have since been adapted for the stage, radio, television, video games and film. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to yet another incarnation of these fantastical tales, a museum exhibition that uses Narnia and recent Hollywood adaptations to teach about science.
Once there were 4 children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edwin and Lucy. This story is about something that happened to them when they were sent away from London during the war because of the air raids.
And so begins The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, a story in which 4 children push their way through heavy coats and other garments hanging in a seemingly ordinary closet to find themselves in a fantasy world of ice and snow. After the wardrobe, there's a lion named Aslan, and a witch, of course, as well as other talking animals and mythological creatures, a stolen throne, and an enchanted kingdom.
When he was about 16 years old, he had a picture come into his head of a fawn in a snowy wood carrying a whole armload of parcels and holding an umbrella.
Douglas Gresham was 8 years old in 1953 when he met C.S. Lewis, whom his mother married 3 years later.
And he just let it go until finally, many years later, he thought, well, I want to try to make a story out of that.
The story sprung those many years later from the mind of a literary scholar known at the time for his writings and talks on the BBC about the rational basis of Christianity.
Most of us can imagine a god attending to any number of claimants if only they come one by one. And he has an endless time to do it in. So what's really at the back of the difference...
Born in Belfast in 1898, the younger of 2 brothers, C.S. Lewis served and was wounded in World War I, then studied English, Greek and Latin at Oxford. He began teaching at Oxford's Magdalen College in 1925, where he bought a house with his older brother and lived the life of a teacher, writer and scholar. But Gresham says the trauma of war had further fueled Lewis's imagination.
He was prone to nightmares ever after his experiences in the First World War, but on this occasion he was dreaming about a huge lion, and as he said afterwards, Aslan leapt into the story and dragged all the rest of Narnia with him.
And so began a midlife journey for Clive Staples Lewis, or to those who knew him, Jack. He was encouraged to write the stories, says Gresham, from conversations with his friend J.R.R., or Ron, Tolkien, who himself would go on to write The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings books.
They both were very concerned that no one at that time, and we're talking about the 1940s now, was writing children's literature that, A, they would have wanted to have read themselves when they were children, or B, children's literature the way it should be written. And so they both decided they'd have a bash at it themselves.
The way it should be written?
Jack realized, I think, probably that he had something valuable to give children in the way of showing them how honor and duty and courage and loyalty and commitment and personal responsibility are so valuable to individuals and how much we need them.
The books became modern classics, shared with each new wave of young readers. Radio and television productions followed. And then in 2005, the feature film The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe was released. Prince Caspian came out last May. Co-producer Gresham says contemporary technology could finally do justice to the mythological creatures on the screen.
From my early teens, and probably earlier than that, I've always thought that the Narnian Chronicles would each make fabulous films, if only we had the technology to do them justice, where we could really do justice to characters like Aslan, for example.
I don't think that Narnia could have been made probably 10 years ago without the great visual effects people that we have around now.
Michael Flaherty is president of Walden Media, which partnered with Disney in the making of the Narnia movies, the costumes, set designs, and music of which are used in the exhibition now at the Franklin Institute. Was the museum show created to market the movie? Michael Flaherty says no, it was the other way around. The movie was conceived as a tool to stimulate learning, based on an idea put forth decades ago by one of America's greatest scientific minds.
Thomas Edison predicted back in the 20s that the motion picture would replace the textbooks because he saw enormous capability in the medium to teach kids.
Flaherty was intrigued by the same possibilities in 2001 during his volunteer experiences teaching urban kids in Boston.
And what I had noticed was that after kids had seen the movie Titanic, it caused them to try to learn a lot more. They got books out of the library, they went to museum exhibits, and they really started to empathize with those people.
Walden Media says Flaherty aims to promote this kind of learning and has made films from stories such as Charlotte's Web and Holes focused on literacy. The Chronicles of Narnia, in turn, have lots of teaching moments, says Eddie Newquist, president of creative and exhibitions for the Becker Group, which produced the exhibition. He points to scientific ideas woven throughout the narrative.
He inserts things like people controlling weather and affecting weather like the White Witch. He talks a lot about treating nature kindly and being careful not to destroy the forest. He also loved time travel, the whole idea that the children can go through this wardrobe into Narnia, but a day may have passed for them, or even a minute in their time, but 1,000 years may have passed in Narnia.
You will now have the chance to explore the world of Narnia.
The museum show juxtaposes real life with fantasy. Its first section is a room devoted to the author, including his letters and personal effects. Then wardrobe-like doors open on cue. The highlights of Narnia are recreated, starting with falling snow. Science themes are explored alongside story details that give rise to them.
And now you have to learn why it's cold all the time. You have to learn about the animals and the creatures, so it's your opportunity to explore it, and you learn things along the way.
Visitors can sit in the White Witch's throne or duck into the hollow of a tree where truffle hunters live. Along the journey are interactive lessons like icy walls that melt at the touch, and a catapult that really works.
There you go. That's all you do.
Great job.
Franklin Institute President and CEO Dennis Wendt says the show is a way of reaching out to people who might not otherwise be drawn to science.
It's another way of communicating science and important environmental and science messages, like animal adaptation and environmental change.
And while Benjamin Franklin never read the books or saw the movies, the exhibition aims to stimulate a human drive the philosophical politician, printer, and inventor knew well.
Franklin was unique because of his extraordinary sense of curiosity. He saw the world as other people saw it, but he understood it in a way that was different. One of our goals is to create opportunities for people to be really curious.
And C.S. Lewis?
I think that he'd be rather thrilled and rather amused to think Narnia itself would take place in a science museum linked in with science. And I'll tell you another thing. I think that if Ben Franklin and my stepfather had met, I think they would have become good friends.
How did Franklin's mind move from life in 18th century Philadelphia to the idea of bifocals, or a lightning rod, or the glass harmonica? Why do some of us see a wardrobe as a place to hang clothes, and others as a door to fantastical adventure? The legacies of C.S. Lewis and Benjamin Franklin may be rightly intertwined. Both looked at what was right in front of them and saw a world beyond.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Chronicles of Narnia, the exhibition, is at the Franklin Institute through April 19th. Next week, the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia opens Scorched, a 2003 play that's been translated into multiple languages and is now being adapted into a feature film. Despite its international success, the Wilma show is just the second production of Scorched in the United States. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the Wilma aims help introduce American audiences to the potency of a work that poetically explores the universal casualties of war.
Scorched was written by Wajdi Mouamouad, who was born in Lebanon, grew up in France, and went to college in Canada, where he now lives. According to Wilma director Blanca Ziska, This Canadian connection might help to explain why the play, produced over 100 times around the world in the last 6 years, is only now making its East Coast U.S. premiere.
We don't see too many plays coming across the border, and it's the same happening in Canada. Canadians do not produce too many American United States plays, but we are trying to break through that a little bit because there are some very interesting voices there.
Scorched tells the story of twins Simon and Janine, whose late mother, Nawal, mysteriously requested in her will that they deliver two letters, one to their father, whom they thought was dead, and another to a brother they never knew existed. To do so, they must journey to a Middle Eastern region long consumed by civil war. The mother's request and her history of strange behavior enrages her son, Simon, played by Irielle Shafir.
For years, she spent day after day at the courthouse attending the trials of all sorts of perverts, sickos, and murderers, then from one day to the next, she shuts up, never says another word. Never. For years. 5 years without a word. That's a hell of a long time. Not another word. Not a sound. Nothing ever came out of her mouth again.
The role of the mother, Nawal, is played by three actors. One of them, Jacqueline Antaramian, thinks there's good reason theaters around the world have been drawn to this story.
You just get knocked out by how beautiful it is, number one, how harsh it is at the same time. And it's brilliantly written, I think, to unravel this very mysterious secret.
The secrets of Nawal lie buried in her homeland. Though the play begins in Montreal, much of it takes place in the Middle East. Where exactly is not explicitly stated.
But it doesn't matter, because there's a broader issue at hand.
One theme highlighted in Scorched is the yearning of children of all ages to connect with the history of their parents, be it in Lebanon, Canada, or elsewhere. Jazz musician Amir El-Safar, who composed the original music featured in the Wilmes production, says he deeply relates to the subject matter of the play. In 2002, El-Safar spent 6 months in Iraq, his father's homeland.
It was during that trip that a lot of the holes kind of got filled in terms of who I am and my psychology and my personality. And clearly in this story, you know, this twin brother and sister, you know, there's a big piece missing in their life and they don't know what it is. Something's not working for either of them. And, you know, it's not until they go through this process of discovering their mother's past, discovering their own past, that they're able to sort of heal and become whole.
While in Iraq, El-Safar researched maqam, the classical music tradition of Iraq. There he learned to play the santur, a type of hammered dulcimer. For Scorched, El-Safar used elements of both traditional Middle Eastern music and contemporary jazz. Just as the set design is minimal, El-Safar says music is used sparingly, rarely overlapping with dialogue.
Because the text is very, very rich in this piece, every word is so loaded and is so powerful that having sound underneath that text would actually be taken away from the meaning. It's almost like someone whispering in your ear, okay, you know, you're supposed to be sad now. Well, it's in the words. You don't need, it's redundant.
While El-Safar tries to avoid interfering with the dialogue, the music is meant to be much more than mere filler between scene changes. Rather, says Blanca Ziska, it should be responding, as in a conversation, to the emotion and tone of the text written by Wajdi Muawmad. Ziska says the play's dialogue bears more resemblance to poetry than any realistic conversation. Long poetic stanzas and plot conventions in Scorched harken back to classic styles of theater, in which characters make long, epic journeys and messengers arrive to report what's happened off stage.
You know, it has a kind of a Shakespearean quality or a Greek tragedy quality. The poetry is there. There is no realism or naturalism in the play. It relies more almost on storytelling. The characters are witnesses to events.
The events depicted span over 50 years. As Nawal's secrets are discovered, the violence and suffering that people endure in times of war are underscored. Though the play is clearly set in the Middle East, Ziska says Scorched steers clear of making political references.
The playwright doesn't want to on purpose use the word Lebanon or Shia or PLO or Israelis. because he doesn't want to point fingers. He really is exploring the human potential for violence and for revenge. Basically, he's telling us that we are much better off by choosing love over hatred.
Love, hatred, family secrets, music, and poetry all played out against the backdrop of war and ethnic conflict. These themes translate into French, English, or any language and resonate on any stage, around the world or at home.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Scorched is at the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia through March 29th. Composer Kyle Smith has been part of the Philadelphia music community for decades, but such a quiet, solid part of it that some of those who have come to be deeply involved with his music didn't even know how to spell his first name last year at this time. It's K-I rather than K-Y-L-E. The composer has enjoyed what many consider to be a breakthrough creative experience with his evening-length choral work, Vespers, which was premiered in early 2008 by the early music group Piffero, which commissioned it, and the virtuoso choir The Crossing. In the coming weeks, the work will be released on the Parma record label. In July, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reported from the recording sessions for the CD, held in the picturesque St. Peter's Church in the Great Valley in Malvern.
The instruments are from the German Renaissance, the voices are from 21st century America, and the music is from, well, we'll get into that a little bit later. But for the moment, choir master Donald Nally is warming up his singers for their very first take. Though this is Kyle Smith's first major recording, the 51-year-old composer has been part of Philadelphia's new music community for decades and has written something in the neighborhood of 100 pieces. During a break in the recording on the breezy lawn outside the church, Smith said that the circumstances of his Vespers have been extraordinary from start to finish.
A lot of times you beat your head against the wall because you've got an idea for a piece that you want to write and you talk to other people and, you know, you struggle with it. But this thing, absolutely, all the pieces just fell together. And it's something that I'd wanted to write for a while. A few years ago, I heard a performance of the Monteverdi Vespers, the 1610 Vespers. But when this conversation came together that Piffero and I were having, and this idea came up, it just exploded into this project that went beyond anything I could control.
Normally, Piffero doesn't play music that's less than 400 years old. Yet, the idea of playing new music isn't really that alien, considering that very old music involves a lot of reinvention. At least in this case, there would be a central authority, the composer, to tell them when they were on the right track. Bringing in conductor Donald Nally and his all-professional virtuoso choir, The Crossing, meant that Smith was dealing with musicians who could cope with most anything. Smith responded by writing music with 16-part harmony, heard here in the January concert premiere of the Vespers. Modern composers love writing this kind of harmonic density, but very few of them have the chance to sustain a 70-minute span of music without an intermission, and since this isn't an opera, without a plot. Conductor Nally discovered this challenge was well in hand.
That variety and the way in which he keeps us constantly, you know, you'll hear voices for a while, and then you hear it with a harp, and then you might hear, and then suddenly you've got the Shams coming in. And, you know. So I think that that helps to sustain the evening very easily. I don't have to work hard to make a drama out of it. You do go on a journey quite naturally through what he wrote.
Even those with faith in Kyle Smith didn't expect this music, not even Piffero's Joan Kimball.
We took a chance, to be sure. And we really didn't know until we started rehearsing what it was going to sound like. And when we first started, our jaws just dropped. this is great. This is really, really good stuff. I'm very excited.
Hardly a paragon of artistic temperament, Kyle Smith lives in Fox Chase with his wife of many years and their three daughters. Professionally, he's the longtime curator of the Fleischer Collection of Orchestral Music at the Free Library of Philadelphia. The psalms and hymns that are a natural part of any Vesper service are ones that he's known as a churchgoer for most of his adult life. His starting point with this piece, however, was visual.
What I had in my mind as a vision was that everyone was going to be sitting in this big church at night, in this big open space, and that this whatever music I was going to write was going to be the first thing that they were going to be hearing. It took me weeks to get these first four bars written, and they're only like four notes in the whole thing. But it took me that long to get them in the right order. And when that happened, the entire piece clicked for me. And then I knew I could write this thing.
Much of the piece came so quickly that when Piffero requested an extra instrumental movement to give the singers a rest, and did so less than a week before the premiere, he wrote it no problem. Many composers consider themselves to be, if not exactly religious, then spiritual. Even when writing something as wild as The Rite of Spring, Igor Stravinsky claimed he was only the conduit of music that came from elsewhere. Kyle Smith is quietly but deeply religious. He recalls experiences he had as a child when he felt the definite presence of God. Obviously, such spirituality is an advantage when writing a Vesper service. Nonetheless, British composer John Ruder has made a career out of composing sacred music and said years back that he didn't necessarily share the religious convictions of his audience. In contrast, when Kyle Smith reads some of the psalms he set to music, he admits that his eyes well up.
There could be composers who don't believe any of this and set it to music and it sounds fine and it sounds pretty. I don't know what the answer is to that. But saying that, there's got to be a way that it strikes you and that it makes sense to you and that it is really important to you. And if it's not, you shouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole because you're wasting your time. You should be doing other things that are important to you.
The difference that I hear is between the external religious experience, the pomp, the pageantry, and the interior experience, which doesn't necessarily deliver answers to age-old questions of existence, but expresses the need for them. And that's more likely to touch all manner of Christians, Jews, Muslims, and maybe even atheists.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Kyle Smith's Vespers by The Crossing and Piffero, conducted by Donald Malley, is released on the Palmer record label in April. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.